Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. Parents can send instant money transfers, automate allowance, and more. Plus, keep an eye on spending with real-time notifications. Join more than 6 million families building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey. That's greenlight.com/odyssey. Did you know that parents rank financial literacy as the number one most difficult life skill to teach? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app for families. With Greenlight, you send instant money transfers, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on your kids' spending with real-time notifications. Kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. And parents can rest easy knowing their kids are learning about money with guardrails in place. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey.
A note of warning. This podcast explores graphic and disturbing stories and includes strong language. It therefore may not be suitable for our young listeners or other folks who may find it disturbing. Hello and welcome to True Crime Daily, the podcast bringing you high profile and under the radar cases from across the country for the week of July 26th, 2019. I'm Billy Jensen and this is Owen Michael.
Hello.
This week, a Pennsylvania dad guns down the guy supposedly feeding his teenage daughter drugs, but police say he got all the details wrong. Police unravel one mystery and discover more after a Louisiana woman brings her dead daughter to the ER claiming there had been an accident. An Iowa man storms off into a blizzard one night in 2009 without his shoes or his keys and vanishes. They finally found him in the last place they looked. But first, a Mississippi college student is found dead miles away from home before anyone knows she's missing. And a fellow student is arrested. What sparked this apparent crime of rage? Owen, what's going on in Mississippi?
This is what we have this week. We've got Alexandria Ali Castiel. She was a 21-year-old student at the University of Mississippi, a school also known as Ole Miss. She was from St. Louis, Missouri area. She was studying marketing at the School of Business. She was in a sorority and in a business fraternity on campus, and she was a founding member and the president of the Ole Miss Golf Club. She was taking classes over the summer at the university and was expected to graduate next spring. On Saturday morning, July 20th, Ali Castiel's body was found about 30 miles north of the Ole Miss campus near Sardis Lake, a swimming and fishing lake next to the Holly Springs National Forest. Lafayette County Sheriff's deputies were on routine patrol when they found Ali's body Saturday. On Monday morning, investigators announced foul play was suspected. Sources told KTVI and other outlets that Ali had been shot 8 times. A preliminary autopsy report concluded Ali died from multiple gunshot wounds, the Oxford Eagle newspaper reported Wednesday. Also on Wednesday, the city of Oxford released surveillance video taken from the historic downtown square, an old town section of shops and restaurants about a mile from the Ole Miss campus. Video shows Ali hugging a friend as she leaves a bar about 10 minutes before midnight on Friday night. She walks to the end of the street, talking on her cell phone. A gray van arrives. She gets in. The van lingers for a minute before taking off. Oxford police say it was a rideshare. The Oxford Eagle reports Ali's roommate said Ali got home about midnight. The roommate was not sure when Ali left again. Ali's body was found hours later at 10:23 that Saturday morning. There are reports of surveillance video from a store in the town of Como, Mississippi, about 20 miles west of the lake where Ali was found. We haven't been able to track that down. So far, the last images of her are from the square.
So Brandon Thiesfeld is a 22-year-old fellow student at Ole Miss. He's studying business administration. And surveillance video shows Thiesfeld at a gas station in South Memphis, Tennessee, at about 9:30 on Monday morning this week. And he's wearing an Ole Miss t-shirt, shorts, and a ball cap as he walks inside. Minutes later, outside, Memphis police officers swarm him in his truck and detain him. Police have been tracking Thiesfeld through his cell phone and his credit card use. And he was taken into custody for questioning. By Tuesday morning, the authorities announced that Thiesfeld had been arrested and had been charged with the murder of Ali Castiel. Fox 13 reports a weapon was found in the truck and that Thiesfeld's clothes had blood on them. He had been transferred to Oxford, Mississippi, where he was booked into the Lafayette County Jail at 3:45 Monday afternoon. He was held this week without bail. He was formally charged with murder Tuesday morning in court. And he's since been suspended from the University of Mississippi. He's from the Fort Worth area of Texas. KMOV-TV quotes a college student who lived in the same dorm as Thiesfeld. Quote, he was pretty much a daddy's boy type, constantly had to reference his father's money, how his dad could get him out of anything, just that attitude all the time. The Oxford Eagle has an interview with another man who ran into Thiesfeld at a bar in San Marcos, Texas, about 2 weeks ago on July 13th. The man went through fraternity rush at Old Miss with Thiesfeld in 2016, but had since transferred to a school in Texas and hadn't seen him since then. And this guy told the Eagle that Thiesfeld was super normal and nothing out of the ordinary that night. Thiesfeld told the man he was visiting someone at Texas State University, but the man said the conversation never got around to dating or girlfriends or Allie. Brandon Thiesfeld's father released a statement to WMC-TV. Quote, I know my son is innocent, and I have reasons to believe that I can't share anything now. But I would ask everybody to please give him the presumption of innocence until proven otherwise.
So KTVI-TV reviewed Thiesfeld's Twitter feed and cited a tweet posted at 7:34 p.m. Saturday, about 9 hours after Allie was found dead. It reads, quotes, "You dropped a bomb on me, my number one pick for groovy song of the summer." That Twitter account has since been taken down. Thursday, pictures emerged on social media showing Allie and Thiesfeld together. Three pics show the two facing the camera together with arms around each other, posing and smiling for the camera in what appear to be at different parties or events in December 2016. Allie Kostiel and Brandon Thiesfeld had dated on and off for at least 2 years, according to friends and acquaintances. KTVI reports that a friend of Allie's tweeted, quotes, "He harassed her for years, took advantage of her for years. I spent countless nights holding Allie close, drying her tears about this monster." The Oxford Eagle reports an attorney who just joined Brandon Thiesfeld's defense team said Thiesfeld will plead not guilty in this case.
We don't know much about this guy other than the obviously her friends. And also, you know, the idea that he was always referencing his father's money is interesting because we'll see how the rubber's going to hit the road with that one.
Indeed. And I'm most interested to, you know, I read a couple of different spots that they have this surveillance video where the two were together supposedly in this other town. That's the sort of damning evidence, if it exists, that I want to see.
Well, they would have been tracking his cell phone. And I think that's probably, if they were tracking a cell phone, which sounds like they were, they've already seen where it had pinged or even looked into the Google data and seen that he was in that place. He knows her. He had a weapon, and he has blood on his clothes.
Eight times.
He's dead to rights.
Eight times is, you know, especially if it seems, you know, it's pure speculation, if they were going up there to, you know, go hang out, or if you went up there to do the thing pre-planned, all allegedly, obviously. But eight times is certainly usually indicative of a lot of rage.
A lot of rage, yeah. But the other interesting thing is that usually with a crime like this, where these people did know each other, they were in a relationship before, mm-hmm. A man using a gun on a woman is not the norm.
Right.
It's usually
hands or a knife.
It's usually hands or a knife. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll see. We'll keep you updated as soon as we know more about that case. It's a lot of people talking about that this week. Do you want to take our next case?
Yeah. Let's go down to Pennsylvania. Beaver Falls, which I believe is where Joan Namath is from. It's a city in Pennsylvania of about 10,000 people located about 40 miles northwest of Pittsburgh. Last Friday, 41-year-old Michael DeBaggio was at his Beaver Falls home while his daughter and his wife were shopping at the local mall. And DeBaggio contacted a 17-year-old high school kid named Darren Jevsak, an acquaintance of his daughter, to ask where he was. And Jevsak replied that, "I'm at work." He's at a pizzeria in Newcastle, which is a few towns over and north of Beaver Falls. And he was a pizza delivery driver. Now, Newcastle News reports that DeBaggio had been hearing all last week that his daughter, whose age has not been publicly released, and Jevsak were in a relationship. DeBaggio later told police that his daughter had been sneaking out of the house to meet up with Jevsak, to smoke pot, use cocaine, and buy drugs from the teen. He had reportedly confronted his daughter on the phone while she was at the mall just prior to him contacting Jevsak. So this is what DeBaggio does. He drives from Beaver Falls to the pizza place in Newcastle, where he saw Darren exit the business out the back door. He later told police he had gone there to talk to the teen, but in the parking lot, he approached the teen, and then he shot Jevsak. A nearby neighbor who witnessed the incident in the parking lot told police she saw DeBaggio shoot Jevsak, who fell to the ground. She said she watched DiBiagio walk closer and then shoot him again.
So KDKA TV reports that the first shot struck Jevsak in the arm. When he fell, the criminal complaint says DiBiagio walked over and shot him in the head, quotes, so that he could put him out of his misery because he looked to be in shock, as he told police. Criminal complaint says DiBiagio shot Jevsak 5 or 6 times, speaking of rage. Mm-hmm. Quotes, he didn't talk to him, said Newcastle Police Chief Robert Salem. He started shooting as soon as he came out of the place of employment. The witness said the pizza shop owner and another employee came outside while DiBiagio went to his car and appeared to reload his gun. Newcastle News newspaper says the two were talking to DiBiagio as he walked away down the street. DiBiagio then put the gun down on the sidewalk and raised his arms for 2 or 3 minutes before he picked up the gun and walked up back to his car and made a phone call. Newcastle News reports that the pizzeria owner asked DiBiagio why he shot Jevsak. And DiBiagio said the teen had gotten his daughter, quotes, hooked on cocaine. So this is what drug dealers get. First responders found Jevsak on the ground, bleeding and unresponsive. He was transported to a hospital where he was pronounced dead. Police officers arrived sometime around 5:25 p.m. Michael DiBiagio laid down on the ground and was arrested without a struggle. He was being held in Lawrence County Jail, charged with criminal homicide and aggravated assault. Police say DiBiagio has admitted to driving to the location and shooting the teen. The police chief said Darren Jevsak did not sell drugs to DiBiagio's daughter. He said they were in a relationship. They had smoked weed together at a party once, according to the USA Today. The police chief says Darren Jevsak was actually working 2 different jobs. By all accounts, he was a good kid. We don't have any record of him for doing any negative incidents.
You know, overprotective dads, you'll do anything to protect your kids. Small town, you hear from somewhere that this is the reason why, whether his daughter was doing drugs or not, we don't know, but this is the reason why that was happening. And then you put 2 and 2 together in your head, you're just filled with all this rage. And then, you know, normally it doesn't come to this, but it did. But
yeah, and I mean, I'm wondering too, you know, small town, you tend to get a little bit more maybe media reports and that kind of thing about the dangers of cocaine and things like that. I'm not familiar with what's going on outside of the suburbs outside of Pittsburgh, but I don't know whether the kids are using cocaine and drugs or whatever, or that's just, I mean, I know when I was in high school, that was a little bit of a panic too, that people thought that the
and now weed's legal and
stuff
here.
Yeah. I mean, weed's one thing, but
Coke is,
I get the escalation. Anyway,
yeah.
No, don't take the law into your own hands, obviously.
It's
tragic.
Yeah. If you want to confront them, go and confront them, but it doesn't look like he even talked to him. He just shot him.
It seems like a rage incident here. So, we've got new stories every week. Subscribe to us here on True Crime Daily on YouTube and on Stitcher, iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. You can check out this story and more of our content on Facebook, Twitter, and, of course, truecrimedaily.com. You can also give us a call at 888-548-9758. You can share your comments or questions, and we'll run them here on the air. Add your voice to the conversation.
And also the photos that we're showing and that we're talking about that we might reference, you can also see all of those photos at the True Crime Daily Facebook page, which is the largest true crime Facebook page in the world.
It's true.
Now we're going to go to Louisiana.
Jasmine Anderson is a 24-year-old resident of Alexandria, Louisiana, which is about 200 miles northwest of New Orleans. Last Thursday, July 17th, Jasmine Anderson walked into the emergency room of a hospital in Alexandria with her 5-year-old daughter, who was unresponsive. Anderson told ER workers that she and her daughter were in a car wreck, resulting in the little girl's neck injury. She told staff it was a single vehicle crash. Medical personnel concluded that the 5-year-old girl was already dead when her mother brought her in. Finding the circumstances suspicious, they called Alexandria police. The injury, quotes, did not seem consistent with what would occur during a crash, a police report says. Anderson had told staff the little girl's head and neck had struck the front passenger's side window. Police officers attempted to locate the scene of the auto accident, but could not find where it supposedly happened. The next day, officers found the site. Reportedly, it was in a field. Detectives investigated the scene, but, quotes, evidence indicated it was not a vehicle crash as described by Anderson, police said. That same Thursday, an autopsy revealed the little girl, 5-year-old Audrey Lynn Chillette, had died as a result of her neck injury. This week, Jasmine Anderson was located and arrested about 10:15 p.m. Tuesday on a charge of second-degree murder. She was held on $500,000 bond. In April of this year, Jasmine Anderson's four-year-old son, Christopher Chillette, Audrey Lynn's brother, died. KLBTV reports the boy's death is now being investigated again after he apparently died in a choking incident involving a bottle cap. Police were called to a residence in Alexandria in April where Anderson told an officer she woke up, went to the bathroom, and noticed the boy on the floor not breathing. She said she hadn't seen the boy for about 45 minutes beforehand. The four-year-old boy was hospitalized. Police say medical personnel were able to get a pulse, but the boy did die 2 days afterward.
Wow. So 3.5 years ago in February 2016, the father of Christopher and Audrey Lynn died. He reportedly hanged himself, according to the USA Today. And Jasmine Anderson and the two children were reportedly in the house when it happened. A source close to the family told the Alexandria Town Talk newspaper that Anderson had tried to drown the two children in a lake near their home in 2017. She had been listed as a missing person leading up to that incident. KLBTV confirms Pineville, Louisiana police responded to at least two calls on April 2, 2017 about a woman who, quote, seemed unstable. The callers were concerned about the welfare of the two small children with her. The caller said Jasmine Anderson had told them she wanted to kill herself and that she wanted to give her children in the lake or river and let it baptize them. One caller said Anderson had tried to give the kids to him. Anderson was hospitalized, then committed for several days, then released. The children had been staying with a relative. One of the children's grandmothers told the Alexandria Town Talk, quote, these kids needed help, and we reached out to everyone we could. We tried to get custody of those babies and weren't allowed. CPS failed my babies. And again, this is a theme that has come up time and time again on this podcast, is CPS. And everyone that's listening to the story right now is saying to themselves, how could this woman still have these kids after that incident? Louisiana Department of Children and Family Services said they had no comment per instructions from the district attorney's office, of course. And the Rapides Parish Sheriff's Office reported that Jasmine Anderson attempted to hang herself with a sheet in her cell this week. She was being held in isolation and was checked on every 15 minutes and made her attempt 2 minutes after the last check on her. She was reportedly flatlined, according to the sheriff, before she was revived by emergency medics and hospitalized. Her condition was not immediately released. Her attorney has requested a mental health evaluation before the case proceeds.
You may recall we did a story last week, which you can find on YouTube, True Crime Daily channel. We had a mother in Northern California who had tried to drown one of her children 10 years ago. And then last week or 2 weeks ago, succeeded in drowning both of her children in a ditch in Northern California. And again, the children were taken away briefly and then were given back. And these are obviously two different states, but it is one of these things. And, you know, it's awful if you're in one of these agencies because you get it right 99 times, but you get it wrong that 100th time. It's a pretty high profile stuff.
And it's the hardest thing to do is take a child away from a parent. Especially a mother, and you always hear the stories about how when there is a custody battle, the mother is always going to be deferred to in most cases. But we're seeing a clear pattern here. And even if the mother looks put together in court and is saying all the right things, if there's that history there, particularly of literally trying to kill the kids before, something must be done. Something must be stepped in. And we're seeing these over and over and over again. And it's not like, and even when we were, you know, running the website and things, maybe like 2 years ago or 3 years ago, I don't remember seeing them at this rapid of a pace of these kind of stories. It's happening more and more, it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't for lack of looking. I mean, we scour national headlines all day long every day and that kind of stuff. It's true. There does seem to be a spate. And I wouldn't want to think whether this is copycat stuff or whatever, because some of these things you wouldn't even hear about if you're in different states. Seems to be clearly a mental health issue, but this one in particular is tragic, and the fact that the kids went back.
Yeah.
So tell us about our next story out of Iowa.
Yeah, Owen. In Iowa, Larry Murillo Moncada was a 25-year-old man, and he went missing in 2009. Larry lived with his parents in Council Bluffs, Iowa, just across the Missouri River from Omaha, Nebraska. And Larry worked a shift on Thanksgiving that year and returned home Friday morning, and he worked at a supermarket. He lived with his parents. His mother said Larry appeared kind of disoriented when he got home that day, so she took him to see a doctor who prescribed an antidepressant for him. Larry's mother said he said he began to hear voices telling him to, quote, eat sugar, and that he was compelled to eat sugar to reduce his racing heartbeat. Later that day, he said someone was following him, his mother told the Daily Nonpareil newspaper. And at 6:15 that Saturday, Larry left the house wearing only pants and a hooded sweatshirt. He wasn't wearing shoes or socks or a proper jacket, and he left his phone, his keys, and his car behind. His parents reported him missing that night. And a Council Bluffs police sergeant said he went missing in the middle of a blizzard. That was the last anyone had seen or heard from Larry. In 2016, the No Frills supermarket closed its doors for good. 3 more years went by. In January of this year, contractors were in the building to remove freezer units, coolers, and shelves from the location. And behind one of the coolers, they found a decomposed body. The body was unrecognizable, but the clothing matched the description of what Larry was wearing when he vanished. Police said the body appeared to have been there for years, and gender, age, and cause of death could not immediately be determined. This week, the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation positively identified the remains as those of Larry Muriela Manqueda. Based on DNA testing from his parents, and investigators ruled his death accidental.
So employees who used to work at this store, the No Frills supermarket in Council Bluffs, Iowa, told police that it was common for employees to climb up on top of coolers in the store, which is a storage area, and they took unofficial breaks during their shifts. A former manager of the store said workers came and went out of the store regularly without being noticed. Police believe Larry went to the store the night he left home. He climbed up but fell behind one of the coolers into a space of about 18 inches between the cooler and the wall and got stuck. And it would have been about a 12-foot fall. We're talking about a huge cooler here. It's believed the noise from the compressors would have been loud enough to muffle any calls for help. It's also a holiday weekend.
Yeah.
It's so loud, there's probably no way anyone heard him, said Council Bluffs Police Sergeant Brandon Danielson, who gave details of the case to the Des Moines Register and other news outlets this week. Danielson is also the officer who was originally assigned to the missing person case in 2009. Larry Muriela Manqueda was the first person who came to mind when the body was found in January, Danielson told the Register. Quotes, the mother, she kind of had an idea that he had never left the No Frills, said Sergeant Danielson.
Wow.
Which is, she had mother's intuition. So we had a lot of comments about this on Facebook, people wondering how they wouldn't hear or they wouldn't smell decomposition or anything like that. I have worked in supermarkets in my formative years, and I can tell you that going into the back, which is basically like a giant warehouse in this kind of area, the odor is awful because you're talking about just – pounds and pounds and pounds of rotting produce from the produce section. You're talking about old food being thrown out, that kind of stuff. Plus, you know, there's gigantic industrial size fans and things like that. It probably would have gone unnoticed. And as they say, the sound itself is really loud and warehouse-like in the back of many supermarkets. But I can tell you that the smell is pretty bad in supermarkets in the back. And, you know, it's not a health issue. It's just this is what happens when you move that that amount of food. So a lot of people were trying to reverse engineer how this would have happened, but it seems like it was a pretty open and shut situation. But just goes to show you that missing persons cases can be tragic even when there's no crime involved.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah. You know, you hear stories like this.
You know,
like the story of there was one of a kid that was found in a chimney.
Yeah.
Remember that story?
Yeah.
And it's just...
The parents have some closure, at least. I mean, they know they have his remains and they know what happened, at least. It's not a mystery. So thoughts and prayers.
So, you know, we get comments.
Speaking of comments.
We get comments. We
get a lot of comments on our Facebook page and our YouTube page.
As well as TrueCrimeMedia.com. On Facebook, we had a story... And I'm going to read it straight from there. Surveillance video shows a mother and former member of the Israeli military chasing down a man who flashed her. She caught him and hopes the situation will send a message to other perps because she gave him a beatdown. It was just after 6 a.m. The single mother had the wind in her hair and a smile on her face as she ran down Memorial Drive in Cambridge, enjoying my beautiful day. I was thinking, what a great day to be alive. Memorial Drive in Cambridge is quite pretty. You can see Boston in the background. Then the unthinkable happened. Guy came up, pulled down his pants once, and, you know, I didn't react too much. And as he came closer, he pulled them down again. And she said, then I understood. Maybe it's not what I think it is. She said the middle-aged man reached out to try to grab her, and then she flipped out. and gave him a beating. And this was something that most of our readers were happy for, but there was some comments that I want to take issue with. So Monica P. said, "I'm glad her military action training put no fear in her. Who knows if she couldn't serve him some Jackie Chan or Bruce Lee kicks. God bless her."
It's Krav Maga, not jujitsu.
That's true. Monique L. said, "I highly doubt she put any fear in him. I don't know why she's saying that." James W. said, "And he could have slit her throat or blew her brains out. Stop trying to be a superhero. What is wrong with you people on our Facebook page? You're allowed to fight back if this happens to you."
Especially Israeli Defense Forces. That they don't mess around.
Oh, you don't mess around.
That's pretty tough. So I'd say that she was a lethal weapon herself.
Yeah. Yep. Terry S. said, "I wish I had done that. I was pumping gas when I was a teen wearing a bikini top because it was hot, and a guy in a Corvette wanted gas. When I came to get his money, he was having fun with himself."
Wow, that sounds like 1970s in a nutshell right there.
Yeah, that's Corvette summer right there. And, Alicia K. said, "I watched the video, and she's a badass. I hope when she catches that creep again, it's on video for all of us to see." So I was disappointed with some of our users. Yes, you never really want to take the law in your own hands, but she was actually going to be, she was not only flashed, this guy was trying to grab her.
You know, it's funny because a lot of people are all about the stand your ground situation when it comes to guns and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
But a woman fighting back and then they have issues with that.
Particular commenters, that's their prerogative.
Yes, yes. That is your cross to bear. So you can check out our content on YouTube and Facebook and truecrimedaily.com. And don't forget to download our weekly podcast on Stitcher, iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play. And if you have comments or questions about the show, call us up and leave us a message at 888-548-9758. We'd love to hear from you. But be advised, your recording may be used on the air in any of our future podcasts. So until next week, this is True Crime Daily, the podcast reminding you,
don't do crimes.